delay, Jamo Reed said, with tears in his eyes again. I suggest a dispensation. Surely these two have proven themselves to our satisfaction. Indignant, Whitmore Blood tugged at his ruffles. The forms must be obeyed. Old Mord Kerr looked at him skeptically. Haven't the Grummans just shown us the folly of too blindly following the forms? The other four masters turned to Rivi Denari for his assessment. Finally, the huge swordmaster levered his enormous body to his feet and gazed at the bedraggled students. He indicated the old duke's sword and the ceremonial Mauritani dagger. Idaho, Resser, draw your weapons. With a clatter of steel, the swordmasters took up their blades, arranged in a sunburst pattern on the semicircular table. His heart pounding, Duncan picked up the old duke's sword from the table, and Resser took the dagger. The five swordmasters formed a circle, including the two students in the ring, and extended their blades toward the center, placing one atop the other. Lay your points on top of the rest, Mord Kerr said. You are now swordmasters, Denari announced in his paradoxically small voice. The huge man sheathed his sword, removed the red bandana from his spiky mahogany hair, and tied it around Duncan's head. Jamo Reed withdrew another bandana and cinched it around Resser's red hair. After 8 years, the rush of triumph and relief brought Duncan to near collapse. But through sheer force of will, he steadied his knees and remained standing. He and Resser grasped each other's hands in celebration, albeit one tainted by tragedy. Duncan couldn't wait to return to Caladan. I have not failed you, Duke Leto. Then a sound like ripping air tore overhead, a succession of sonic booms from descending atmospheric craft. From the reefs that circled the central island, unexpected sirens went off. Much closer, an explosion echoed from the walls of the administration buildings. The senior swordmasters sprinted to a balcony that overlooked the complex. Across the channels of still water, two nearby islands glowed with smoky fires. Armored airships, Jamo Reed said. Duncan saw black predatory forms swoop out of the pillars of flame, in steep climbs as they dropped streams of explosives. Jay Wu snarled, tossing his dark hair. Who would dare attack us? To Duncan, the answer seemed obvious. House Mauritani isn't done with us yet. It flies in the face of all civilized warfare, Rivi Denari said. They have not declared Canley, have not followed the proper forms. After what he has done to us, to Akaz, what does Viscount Mauritani care about the forms? Resser said in disgust. You don't understand how his mind works. More bombs exploded. Where's our anti-aircraft fire? Whitmore Blood sounded more annoyed than outraged. Where are our thopters? No one has ever attacked Ginaz before, Jamo Reed said. We are politically neutral. Our school serves all houses. Duncan could see how these masters had been blinded by their egos, their rules and forms and structures. Hubris. They had never conceived of their own vulnerabilities, despite what they taught their students. With a foul stream of expletives, Denari pushed binoculars against the folds of fat on his face. He flicked the oil lens settings and, ignoring the oncoming armored craft, scanned the rugged edge of the administrative island. Enemy commandos are all over that shore, landing opposite the spaceport, approaching with shoulder-mounted artillery. Must have come in by submarine, Jay Wu said. This isn't an impromptu attack. They've been planning it for quite some time. Waiting for an excuse, Reed added, a deep frown creasing his tanned face. The attacking airships drew closer, thin black disks shimmering with defensive shields. To Duncan, the swordmasters appeared so helpless, almost pathetic, when faced with this unexpected situation. Their hypothetical exercises were far different from reality, painfully so. He gripped the old duke's sword. Those ships are unmanned flyovers made to drop bombs and incendiaries, Duncan said with cool assessment, as a rain of bombs fell from the roaring disks. Buildings blossomed into fire all along the shoreline. Shouting, the proud swordmasters ran from the balcony, with Resser and Duncan in their midst. "We need to get to our stations! Do what we can to guide the defense!" Denari's thin voice was sharpened with command. "The rest of the new trainees are at the spaceport," Resser pointed out. "They can grab equipment and fight back." Off balance, but struggling to recover, especially in front of the even more panicked officials and administrators, Jamo Reed, Mord Kerr, and Jay Wu charged along the main corridor, while Rivi Denari showed how fast he could move his bulk, vaulting down a stairway by holding handrails and leaping from landing to landing. Whitmore Blood scuttled behind him. After exchanging quick glances, Duncan and Resser followed the two swordmasters who'd gone down the stairway. A nearby explosion rocked the administration building, and the young men stumbled. Still, they kept going. Outside, the full-scale attack continued. The new swordmasters surged through a door at ground level into the central lobby, joining Denari and Blood. Through the armor plaza windows, Duncan could see buildings burning outside. "We've got to get to your command center," he said to his elders. "We need the equipment to fight. Are there attack thopters at the spaceport?" Resser held his ceremonial Mauritani dagger. "I'll fight right here, if they dare send anyone in to face us." Blood looked agitated. He had dropped his colorful cloak somewhere on the stairs. "Don't think small. What is their goal? Of course they'll be after the vault." In dismay, he nodded toward an ornate black coffin on a dais that dominated the lobby. "Jules Noritz remains the most sacred object on all of Guinaz. Can you think of a greater insult to us?" With a flushed face, he turned toward his enormous companion. "It would be just like the Grummans to hit us in the heart." Perplexed, Duncan and Resser looked at each other. They had been steeped in tales about the legendary fighter. But in the face of this bloody attack, the exploding bombs, the screaming civilians rushing for shelter on the island streets, neither of them could care much about the old relic. Denari rushed across the floor like a battleship moving at full speed. "To the vault!" he shouted. Blood and the others tried to keep up with him. The famous burial vault was surrounded by clear armor plaza and a shimmering Holtzman-generated shield. Eschewing all arrogant pretenses, the two swordmasters rushed up the steps and pressed their palms against a security panel. The shield faded, and the armor plaza barriers lifted. "We'll carry the sarcophagus," Blood shouted to Duncan and Resser. "We must keep this safe. It is the very soul of the Guinaz school." Constantly looking around for attackers in Mauritani uniforms, Duncan balanced the old Duke's sword in his grip. "Take the mummy if you have to, but be quick about it." Resser stood at his side. "Then we've got to get out of here and find some ships so we can fight." Duncan hoped that the other Guinaz defenses were already rallying to strike back against the attackers. While the senior swordmasters, both strong men, lifted the ornate coffin and carried it toward the dubious safety outside, Duncan and Resser cleared the way. Outside, the black disks continued their indiscriminate rain of bombs. A gunthopter with school markings landed in the plaza in front of the administration building. It folded its wings while the engines continued to thrum. Half a dozen swordmasters leaped from the craft wearing single suits and red bandanas, with laser rifles slung over their shoulders. "We've got Noret's body," Blood called proudly, gesturing to the thopter for assistance. "Come quickly." Soldiers in yellow Mauritani uniforms ran across the plaza. Duncan shouted a warning, and the swordmasters fired laser guns at the attackers. The Grumman soldiers responded with their own weapons. Two swordmasters were hit, including Jamo Reed. When an aerial bomb exploded, old Mord Kerr sprawled down, injured in the arms and torso by flying stone splinters. Duncan helped the shaggy-haired instructor to his feet and into the safety of the thopter. Just as he got Kerr inside, though, a charging attacker knocked Duncan's legs out from under him. The young swordmaster tumbled to the pavement, rolled, and sprang to his feet again. Before he could extend his sword, A Grumman woman in a yellow martial arts gi dove under his guard, slashing at him with claw knives on her fingers. With his sword useless at such close range, he grabbed the attacker's long hair and jerked back hard enough to hear her neck snap. The assassin melted to the ground, limp and twitching. More Grummans converged on the gunthopter. Resser shouted, "Go, take the damn coffin with you!" He and Duncan whirled to face another opponent. A bearded man lunged with a sparking electrical spear, but Duncan ducked the blow and spun to one side. His thoughts accelerated as he summoned the proper response from 8 years of training. Rage threatened to overtake him, rising in red waves as he remembered the captive student slaughtered on the dark boat. His retinas burned with vivid images of the bombs and fire and the slain innocents. But he remembered Denari's admonition. With anger comes error. In an instant, he settled on a cold, almost instinctive response. With sheer force of will, Duncan Idaho slammed steely fingertips under the lunging man's ribcage, breaking skin and piercing his heart. Then a cagey young man stepped from the fray, lean and muscular, with his injured right wrist sealed in a padded cast. Trin Kronos. The surly young lordling grasped a sharp-bladed katana in his good hand. "I thought you two would be feeding the fish, like the other four examples we made." He looked up at the soaring bombers. Another huge explosion took down a low building. "Face me, Kronos," Resser said, drawing his ceremonial Mauritani dagger. "Or are you too much a coward without your father and a dozen guards armed with heavy weaponry?" Trin Kronos held his katana, considered, then cast it aside. "Too good a weapon for a traitor. I would have to throw it away after I soiled it with your blood." He withdrew a dueling knife instead. "A dagger is easier to replace." Resser's cheeks flushed, and Duncan stepped back to watch the two confront each other. "I would never have forsaken House Mauritani," Resser said, "if they'd given me anything I could believe in." "Believe in the cold steel of my blade," Kronos said with a cruel sneer. "It will feel real enough when it cuts out your heart." With broken rubble underfoot, the two circled cautiously, not breaking each other's gaze. Resser held up his dagger, maintaining a solid defensive posture, while Kronos jabbed and slashed, aggressive but ineffective. Resser attacked, withdrew, then swept out his foot in a vicious kick that should have knocked Kronos to the ground. But the Grumman fighter bent backward like a snake, drawing himself away from the redhead's foot. Resser spun all the way around and recovered his balance, deflecting a swift knife blow. The area around the two combatants was clear. In nearby streets, other Grumman attackers continued to raid, and projectile fire rang out from high windows. At the thopter, the swordmasters struggled with their relic, trying to lift the sarcophagus into their aircraft while fighting off attackers. Kronos fainted, slashed at Resser's eyes with the tip of his dueling knife, then stabbed for the throat. Resser threw himself to one side, neatly out of range. But his foot came down on a loose chunk of rock. His ankle twisted, and he stumbled. Kronos was upon him like a lion, pouncing and bringing the knife down. But Resser slapped sideways with his own dagger, knocking the other blade aside with a clang. Then he jabbed upward, sliding the point into his opponent's bicep and tracing a red cut down past the elbow to the forearm. With a childish cry, Kronos staggered back, looking at the scarlet river pouring down to his uninjured wrist. "Bastard traitor!" Resser bounced to his feet and focused his stance again, ready to fight. "I'm an orphan, not a bastard." His lips curved in a quick, wan smile. His arm slick with blood, his knife hand weak, Kronos could see that he had lost the knife fight. His face hardened. Upending his fighting dagger, he brought the pommel down on his thick wrist cast. It split open along a planned seam, and a spring-loaded flechette pistol popped into his grip. Kronos grinned, thrusting the weapon forward, preparing to fire a full load of the silver flechettes into Resser's chest. "You still insist on following your absurd rules, don't you?" "I don't," Duncan Idaho said from behind as he thrust mightily with the old Duke sword. The point pierced between the shoulder blades of Trinkronos and emerged from his chest, sliding all the way through his heart. Kronos coughed blood and shivered, astonished at the sharp object that had sprouted from his sternum. As Kronos slumped dead, he slid off the bloody blade. Duncan stared at his victim and at the sword. Grummans aren't the only ones who can break the rules. Resser's face had gone gray, having accepted the inevitability of his death as soon as he saw the pistol hidden in Kronos's cast. Duncan, you stabbed him in the back.
I saved the life of my friend, Duncan replied. Given the same options, I would make that choice every time.
Denari and Blood finished tying down the sacred relic aboard the Thopter. Laser arcs filled the air as Ganaz defenders fired with deadly accuracy. The two young men stood exhausted, but the Swordmasters pulled them aboard the Thopter. With a great thrust of jets, the gunship surged into the air. The wings reached full extension, transporting the passengers and the body of Jewel Noret away from the main buildings. As Duncan huddled on the metal deck, Rivi Denari leaned over to place a thick arm around his shoulders.
You boys had to prove yourselves early.
What's this attack all about? Wounded pride? Duncan asked, so angry he wanted to spit. A foolish reason to begin a war?
There are rarely good reasons to begin wars, Mordkur said, hanging his head.
Whitmore Blood tapped the transparent plaz.
Look out the window.
A swarm of Ganaz gunships fired laser blasts at the enemy aircraft and mowed down troops on the ground.
Our new swordmasters are at the controls, your fellow students from the spaceport, Kerr said.
After a direct hit, one of the unmanned flyovers exploded and plummeted. The swordmasters raised their fists inside the cramped thopter. The flyover hit the ground in a fireball, and a second vessel crashed into the ocean. Laser beams struck more of them out of the skies. Duncan's thopter dove toward a squad of Grumman commandos rushing back over the water and blasted them, leaving bodies strewn on the ground. The pilot went around for another pass.
The Grummans expected easy pickings, Whitmore Blood said.
And damned if we didn't provide them, Jay Wu growled.
Duncan watched the mayhem and tried not to compare the rampant destruction and bloodshed with all the finesse he had learned in 8 years at the Ganaz school.
Beware the seeds you sow and the crops you reap. Do not curse God for the punishment you inflict upon yourself.
Orange Catholic Bible. Employing indignant propriety that would have made even the Lady Helena proud, Kylea convinced Leto not to include his son in the grand ducal procession.
I do not want Victor exposed to any danger. That sky clipper isn't safe for a 6-year-old boy.
Thufir Hawat proved to be an unexpected ally, agreeing with Kylea's concerns, until finally Leto relented, exactly as she had hoped. After the Duke's capitulation, Kylea helped Romber to salvage the situation.
You're Victor's uncle. Why don't you two go on a fishing expedition? Take a wingboat along the coast, as long as you're accompanied by enough guards. I'm sure Captain Guar would be happy to join you.
Romber brightened.
Maybe we'll go out and collect coral gems again.
Not with my son, Kylea said sharply.
All right, I'll just take him out to the floating Paradan melon farms and maybe to some coves where we can look at the fish.
Swain Guar met Romber down by the docks as they cleaned out the hold of the small, well-equipped motorboat, Dominic. Preparing to be gone for several days, they took bedrolls and food. Behind the castle, at the spaceport on the outskirts of Kala City, the Duke's crew labored to prepare the enormous skyclipper. Anxious to be off, Leto was utterly absorbed with final arrangements. As work continued at the boat, Victor became irritable and less than enthusiastic. At first, Romber thought the boy might still remember the Alacran encounter,
But instead, he saw Victor glance repeatedly up at the plateau where his father was about to embark on his journey. Atreides' banners rippled in the air, reflective streamers of green and black.
"I'd rather be with my daddy," Victor said. "Fishing is fun, but riding on a sky clipper is better."
Romber leaned against the side of the boat. "I agree, Victor. I wish there was some way for us to join him." Duke Leto intended to pilot the skyship himself, accompanied by an appropriate escort of 5 loyal soldiers. With the limited amount of weight allowable in the lighter-than-air vessel, it was not wise to take joyriders. Swain Guar dropped a crate of provisions outside the bridge house, then wiped sweat from his forehead and smiled at the boy. Romber knew that the captain was more dedicated to the boy than to any law or other master. Adoration for Leto's son flickered across Guar's handsome face.
Captain, let me ask your opinion.
Romber looked at Victor, then back at the guard captain.
You've been entrusted with the safety of this child, and you've never once been known to shirk your duties or give anything less than full attention to your assignment.
Guar flushed with embarrassment. Romber continued.
Do you believe my sister's fears that Victor would actually be in danger if he accompanied Leto aboard the Sky Clipper?
Laughing, Guar made a dismissive gesture.
Of course not, my lord prince. If there was any danger, Thufir Hawat would never allow our duke to go. And neither would I. Hawat charged me to oversee the security of the clipper itself before it departs, while he and his men scour the flight path for any signs of ambush. It is completely safe, I assure you. I'd stake my life on it.
My thoughts exactly. Romber rubbed his palms together and grinned. So, is there a particular reason why Kylea should insist that we take a fishing trip rather than go along? Pursing his lips, Guar considered the question. He wouldn't meet Romber's gaze.
Lady Kylea is sometimes excessive in her concern for the boy. I believe she imagines threats where there are none.
Little Victor looked from one man to the other, not understanding the nuances of the discussion.
Spoken with true candor, Captain. I can't imagine why you haven't been promoted.
Then Romber lowered his voice to a stage whisper.
Why don't we have Victor join his father, in secret? He shouldn't miss this magnificent procession. He is the Duke's son, after all. He needs to take part in important events.
I concur. But there is the issue of weight ratios. The Sky Clipper has limited passenger capacity.
Well, if there's truly no danger, why don't we remove 2 members of the Honor Guard so that my dear nephew,
Romber squeezed Victor's shoulder, and I can join the Duke? That still leaves 3 guards, and I can do my share of fighting to protect Leto if it comes to that.
Though uneasy, Guar could voice no reasons to counter this suggestion, especially not after he saw the delight on Victor's face. The boy made his resistance melt.
Commander Hawat won't like any change of plans, and neither will Kylea.
True, but you are in charge of security on the airship itself, correct?
Romber brushed aside the concern.
Besides, Victor can't possibly grow into a good leader if he is sheltered from every splinter and bruise. He needs to get out and learn from life, no matter what my sister says.
Guar bent in front of the delighted boy, treating him like a little man.
Victor, tell me true. Do you want to go fishing, or...
I want to go on the Sky Clipper. I want to be with my father and see the world.
His eyes were filled with determination. Guar stood up. For a moment he held Victor's gaze, wanting to do anything in his power to make the boy happy.
That's all the answer I needed.
It's decided, then. He looked back toward the spaceport where the dirigible waited. I'll go make the arrangements. Afraid her mannerisms might give something away, Kylea sequestered herself in one of the towers of Castle Caladan, feigning illness. She'd already said her formal goodbye to a preoccupied Leto, then hurried away before he could look into her eyes. Not that he paid much attention to her anyway.
A cheering crowd watched the ducal procession as it prepared to lift off into the blue Caladan sky. The Atreides hawk was painted in brilliant red across the swollen side of the sky clipper, which would be followed by smaller but similarly designed airships, all colorfully decorated. The sky clipper deployed sails to catch the winds and strained against its tethers like a mammoth, turgid bee. Atreides' banners fluttered in a light breeze. The bulk of the airship was empty space, enclosed pockets of buoyant gas, but the tiny passenger compartment in the belly had been filled with provisions. Guiding sails flapped out like butterfly wings at the sides. Thufir Hawat had checked the proposed route himself, trudging down roads and dispatching guards and inspectors to ensure that no assassins had secreted themselves along the way. Biting her lip, Kailia watched from the high window that faced inland, where she could see the colorful aircraft. Though she only faintly heard the fanfare playing to see Leto off, she saw figures standing on podiums, waving before they climbed aboard the sky clipper. Her stomach knotted. She admonished herself for not obtaining a pair of binoculars. But that might have raised suspicions. A foolish worry. The household servants would simply have assumed that she wanted to watch her beloved Leto depart on his historic procession. The people of Caladan knew nothing of the dark side of their relationship. In their naivete, they imagined only romantic stories. With a pang in her heart and a sense of inevitability, Kailia watched the work crews release the tethers. Raised by suspensor-assisted floats, the sky clipper drifted gracefully into the air currents. The sluggish craft had propulsion systems that could be used in an emergency, but Leto preferred to let the giant vessel move with the winds whenever possible. Smaller companion ships followed. Though alone, Kailia Vernius tried to clear all expression from her face, all emotion from her mind, not wanting to recall the good times she'd had with her noble lover. She had waited long enough, and she knew in her soul that it would never happen the way she'd wanted it. Romber, despite his dabbling with a few rebels, had accomplished nothing on Ix. Nor had their father, in all his years of supposed underground struggle against House Carino. Dominic was dead, and Romber was content to be Leto's anonymous sidekick, enthralled with his plain Bene Gesserit woman. He had no ambitions at all. And Kailia couldn't accept that. She gripped the stone windowsill, watching the glorious procession of airships drift over Cala City and away to the lowlands. The commoners would stand knee-deep in their marshy fields and look up to see the Duke's passage. Kailia's lips formed a firm, straight line. Those Pundi rice farmers would get much more of a sight than they expected. Kiara had told her the details of the plan only after it had already been initiated. Having once been the mistress of a munitions expert, Kiara had personally set a trap, using linked explosives stolen from the Atreides armory. There would be no chance of survival, no hope of rescue. Feeling helpless dread, Kailia closed her eyes. The wheels had been set in motion, and nothing she could do would prevent the disaster now. Nothing. Soon her son would be the new duke, and she would be his regent mother. "Ah, Victor, I am doing this for you." Hearing footsteps, she was surprised to see Jessica appear at the door to her room, already returned from the launching of the ducal ship. Kailia stared at her rival with a stony expression. Why couldn't she have accompanied Leto? That would have solved even more of her problems. "What is it you want?" Kailia said. Jessica looked slender and delicate. Yet Kailia knew that no young woman with Bene Gesserit training could ever be helpless. The witch could probably kill Kailia in an instant with her weirding ways. She promised herself she would get rid of this seductress as soon as the weight and responsibility of House Atreides fell across her shoulders. "I will be regent for my son." "Now that the Duke has gone and left us alone, it is time for us to talk.
Jessica watched Kailia's reaction. "We've avoided it for too long, you and I."
Kailia felt as if every nerve on her face and in her fingers, every twitch and gesture, were being dissected through this upstart's scrutiny. It was said that a Bene Gesserit could read minds, though the witches themselves denied it. Kailia shuddered, and Jessica took a step deeper into the room.
"I'm here because I want privacy," Kailia said. "My duke has departed, and I wish to be alone."
Jessica's brow furrowed. Her green eyes stared intently, as if she had already detected something wrong. Kailia turned away, feeling naked. How could this young woman expose her so easily?
"I thought it would be better if we did not leave so much unspoken between us," Jessica continued. "Leto may decide to marry soon, and it won't be to either of us."
But Kailia did not want to hear any of it. "Does she wish to make peace with me? To ask my permission to love Leto?" The thought brought a flickering smile to her face. Before Kailia could respond, she heard footsteps again, booted feet. Swain Gwar lunged into the room. He looked unsettled, his formal uniform disheveled. He stopped for a moment upon seeing Jessica there in the chamber, as if she were the last person he had expected to encounter with Kailia.
"Yes, Captain, what is it?" Kailia snapped.
He fumbled for words, unconsciously touched his thick belt, then flickered to the tiny uniform pocket where he usually kept his coded armory key.
I have misplaced something, I fear."
"Captain Gwar, why aren't you with my son?" Kailia vented anger toward him in hopes of distracting Jessica. "You and Prince Romber were scheduled to depart on your fishing trip hours ago." The handsome guard avoided her gaze, while Jessica stared at both of them, recording each movement. Kailia's heart froze. Does she suspect? And if so, what will she do about it?
"I seem to have lost an important piece of equipment, my lady," he stammered, looking very embarrassed. "I've been unable to find it, and now I am growing concerned. I intend to search for it in every possible place."
Kailia stepped closer to him, her face flushed.
"You didn't answer my question, Captain. You three should have gone fishing. Did you delay my son's trip so he could watch his father depart?"
She touched a finger to her frowning lips.
"Yes, I can see how Victor would have enjoyed watching the airships. But take him now. I don't want him to miss the fishing trip with his uncle. He was very excited about it."
"Your brother requested a slight change of plans, my lady," Gwar said, uncomfortable with Jessica's presence and at being caught in his mistake. "We'll schedule another fishing trip for next week, but Victor wanted so much to accompany Duke Leto. This sort of procession is very rare. I didn't have the heart to refuse him."
Kailia whirled, aghast. "What do you mean? Where is Victor? Where's Romber?"
"Why, they're aboard the Sky Clipper, my lady. I will inform Thufir Hawat." Kailia rushed to the window, but the huge airship and its companions had already drifted far out of sight. She battered her fist on the transparent plaz of the window and let out a loud, keening wail of despair. Every man dreams of the future, though not all of us will be there to see it. T.O. Holtzman, Speculations on Time and Space. Aboard the Sky Clipper, Leto relaxed in the command seat. The ship rose high above the city and drifted over the surrounding agricultural areas. So peaceful, gentle, quiet. He moved the rudders, but allowed the winds their whim. In utter silence and perfect grace, they cruised over lush terrain at the head of the procession of ships. He looked down upon broad rivers, thick forests, and marshes where standing pools glittered. Victor stared wide-eyed out the viewing windows, pointing at sights and asking 1,000 questions. Romber answered, but deferred to Leto when the name of a landform or clustered village exceeded his knowledge.
I'm glad you're here, Victor.
Leto good-naturedly mussed the boy's hair. Three guards were stationed aboard, one in the main cabin and the others at the fore and aft exits. They wore black uniforms with the Red Hawk epaulets of the Atreides Honor Guard. Since he had replaced one of their members for this trip, Romber wore the same uniform. Even Victor, who had also replaced a guard because of weight limitations on the Sky Clipper, wore the epaulets on his replica of the Duke's black jacket. On the boy, the epaulets were oversized, but he insisted on wearing them. Romber began to sing folk songs, rhymes he'd picked up from locals. In recent months, he and Gurney Halleck had shared Balisette duets, playing tunes and singing ballads. At the moment, Romber simply enjoyed singing in his rough voice, without any accompaniment. Hearing a familiar chanty, one of the guards joined in. The man had grown up on a Pundi rice farm before joining the Atreides troops, and still remembered the songs his parents had taught him. Victor tried to sing along too, adding the intermittent but not always correct words of a chorus when he thought he remembered them. Though large, the sail-driven Sky Clipper was an easy craft to handle, a vessel made for leisurely voyages. Leto promised himself that he would do this more often. Perhaps he'd take Jessica with him, or even Kylea. Yes, Kylea. Victor should see his mother and father spend more time together, regardless of their political or dynastic differences. Leto still had feelings for her, though she had rebuffed him at every turn. Remembering how cruel his own parents had been to one another, he did not want to leave such a legacy for Victor. It had been an oversight at first, worsened by his stubbornness when Kylea began making unreasonable demands about marriage. But he realized he should have at least made her his bound concubine and given their son the Atreides name. Leto had not yet decided to accept Archduke Ekaz's formal offer of marriage to Alessa. But one day he would certainly find a politically acceptable match for himself among the Landsrad candidates. Still, he loved Victor too much to deny the boy's status as firstborn. If he designated the child as his official heir, perhaps Kylea would warm to him. Eventually bored with the singing and the Sky Clipper's ponderous pace, Victor craned his neck upward to look at the rippling sails outside. Leto let him handle the control grip for a few moments, turning the rudder. The boy was thrilled to see the Sky Clipper's nose nudging in response to his commands. Romber laughed. "You'll be a great pilot someday, boy. But don't let your father teach you. I know more about piloting than he does." Victor looked from his uncle to his father, and Leto laughed to see him ponder the comment with such seriousness. "Victor, ask your uncle to tell you how he set our coracle on fire once, then crashed it into a reef."
"You told me to crash it into the reef," Romber said.
"I'm hungry," Victor said, not surprising Leto at all. The boy had a hearty appetite and was growing taller every day. "Go look in the storage cabinets in the back of the bridge deck," Romber said. "That's where we keep our snacks." Anxious to explore, Victor ran to the rear of the deck. The Sky Clipper passed over Pundi rice paddies, soggy green fields separated by sluggish canals. Barges drifted along below them, filled with sacks of the native grain. The sky was clear, the winds gentle. Leto could not imagine a better day for flying. Victor stood on a ledge to reach the topmost cabinets, rummaging among the shelves. He studied iconic images on the labels. He couldn't read all the Gaelic words, but recognized letters and understood the purposes of certain things. He found dried meats and uluus, wrapped berry pastries as a special dessert for the evening. He gobbled one package of uluus, which satisfied his immediate hunger, but he continued to poke about. With the curiosity of a child, Victor moved to a bank of storage pockets built into the gondola's lower wall against the dirigible sack that made up the bulk of the Sky Clipper. Identifying the red symbol, he knew that these were emergency supplies, first aid equipment, medicines. He had seen such things before, watching in awe as how surgeons bandaged cuts and scrapes. Opening the first aid pocket, he withdrew medical supplies, scrutinized gauze wrappings and pill packets. A loose cover plate on the back wall rattled intriguingly, so he popped it out to find another compartment even deeper within. Inside a sheltered wall behind the emergency supplies, Victor found something with blinking lights, a glowing counter, impedance transfer mechanisms connected to clusters of red energy storage containers, all strung together. Fascinated, he stared for a long time.
"Uncle Romber, come see what I found."
Smiling tolerantly, Romber strode across the deck, ready to do his best to explain whatever the child had encountered.
"There, behind the doctor kits."
Victor pointed with a small finger.
"See? It's bright and pretty."
Romber stood behind the boy, bent over to squint. Proud and proprietary, Victor reached deeper inside.
"Look at how all the lights blink. I'll get it so you can see better."
The boy grasped the device, and Romber suddenly sucked in a sharp breath.
"No, Victor, that's a..."
Duke Leto's son jostled the impedance leads and activated the tamper lock timer. The explosives detonated. Knowledge is pitiless. Orange Catholic Bible. When flames erupted from the aft end of the Skyclipper cockpit, the shockwave slammed into Leto like a meteor. A burned and broken mass of flesh smashed into the front viewing wall beside him, then dropped to the floor. Too large for a child, too small to be a man, a whole man, it left a smear of blackened bodily fluids. Searing heat roared around him as the air crackled with flames. The rear of the dirigible blazed, engulfed in orange fire. Yelling uselessly in horrified confusion, Leto wrestled the rudder controls as the wounded Skyclipper bucked and reared. Out of the corner of his eye, he couldn't stop looking at the broken form beside him. It twitched. Who was it? He didn't want to know. A parade of awful images assaulted his retinas, one at a time, lasting the merest fraction of a second. Behind him, he heard a screaming wail that changed abruptly, then dwindled as the flailing silhouette of a man was sucked through a gaping blast hole torn in the bottom of the cabin. The man's entire body was in flames. It had to be either Romber or one of the three guards. Victor had been at the center of the explosion. Gone forever. The crippled Skyclipper began to plummet, losing buoyancy as the flammable gas was consumed inside the dirigible's body. The fabric tore away, and yellow-white fire towered higher. Smoke filled the cockpit. Leto's flesh was hot, and he knew his fine black uniform would soon be in flames. Beside him, the wreck of the unidentified body made a mewling sound of pain. He seemed to have the wrong number of arms and legs, and his face was a bloody mass of twisted, unrecognizable flesh.